Hey fam, thanks for checking this little recording out. If you're listening to this, it means you must have attended a talk, workshop, or even a class of mine that I recorded, and you want to get the nitty gritty. That's great. Excellent. If you're just being snoopy and you're trying to figure things out, it's all good. My name's Dan White Hodge. I'm an educator, and you're about to learn something today. Thanks again for following up, and I truly hope this adds an enrichment to you and your work. As always, hit me up if you got them questions at whitehodge.com and check out my podcast while you're at it, Profane Faith. I'll talk with you later. Peace. Well, folks, welcome back to the show once again. Going to learn today, the podcast where you learn, you put some stuff together. Today, I have a good friend of mine and colleague. I'm so glad we had a chance to just meet and that we actually work together, Dr. Katie O'Toole. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you, Dan?
You know, I'm hanging in there. I'm glad to have you on today. When I found out your research area was like in this whole psychology, media, multitasking, all that stuff, I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And so I know you've come to class a few times, but let's just hop right in. What's the breakdown? What's going on here?
Sounds good. Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here and share my work with you and your subscribers. Just to give a little bit of background, in graduate school, I studied cognitive development, particularly the development of attention in young children. And the way we study attention development in young children is we distract them. So we present them with background television and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And then when I came to North Park, I wanted to continue my program of research, but there are very few preschoolers on a college campus. And so I had to adapt my program to study similar constructs, but with a older population. And by older, I mean older than preschoolers. So looking at college students, young adults. And one of the biggest distractors in this age group are smartphones. And that's what my research focuses on.
I love it.
And of course, you know, smartphones offer many advantages for us, right? We use them to complete daily tasks. You know, we stay in regular communication with loved ones. We can access information. We can capture and store memorable moments. But there's a disruptive side to them. And we see as a society, we're becoming much more vocal about the appropriate times and settings for using our devices. And so understanding the different ways that they're disruptive, particularly to our cognitive functioning and our emotional functioning, grows increasingly important. And this is the area of psychology that I study.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Yeah. I mean, because I think I know that's something that I've definitely had in the back of my mind, raising a young child of mine that is... Mm-hmm. grown up around these type of tools, right? It's like you said, they offer a lot of good things, but there's also a side of it that is I don't want to say distraction, but it is distraction. And I think about, you know, generations growing up, in regards to some of the newer generations, you know, particularly kids that are born after 2010, their world will, you know, never have known anything other than the internet. It's like I can still remember days, you know, as a kid that I did not have access to the internet. It was like you go to the laundromat, that was it. You sat there and whatever was on that crummy little black and white TV, that was it. And, you know, my daughter's generation has, you know, no concept of that. But let's peer further into this. And what's some of the specific work that you've done and particularly some of the research that you've done in regards to all this area here?
Yeah. So that's so interesting to hear your anecdote about that. It just reminds me of like waiting in line as a kid and how just you had to be bored and entertain yourself.
Right.
That's just not the case anymore. So my research is driven by the fact that I'm a teacher first and foremost. I'm very curious about how smartphones affect my students inside and outside the classroom. I'm really big on creating environments that are conducive for learning. And when we are perpetually preoccupied by our devices, right, that makes learning more difficult. And I created a study to look at the cost of smartphones on academic work. And before I talk about my specific study, I need to talk a little bit about interference. So in psychology, the term interference is really something that hinders or impedes a process. So as human beings, we have goals, we have tasks that need to get done, homework that needs to get submitted, houses that need to get cleaned, children that need tending to. And we have to do this while there is this river of information around us. And that's not all technological, right? It could be background TV, it could be our smartphone, but we have to get these goals done while trying to talk to a spouse or trying to think about what to make for dinner, remembering to wash our hands. So we as humans are used to interference. We're used to being challenged when trying to fulfill our daily goals. But this new technological world creates interference that's more frequent and to an extent a little bit more intense. So we can cope with interference, but where's that breaking point?
Okay.
And so interference can really be broken down into two different kinds, or there are two general sources of interference. Some interference is external. So this external interference is any sensory stimuli that arises from the environment that's disruptive. This is like our smartphone. Let's say you are paying attention to a teacher in class, or you're in a meeting and you're listening to a speaker and your smartphone goes off.
Yeah.
You are attempting to multitask with that source of external interference. You're trying to pay attention to the speaker or the teacher and get your texting done. So that's one way that external interference disrupts us. External interference can also be ignored, right? So again, going back to that example, we are trying to pay attention to a teacher or a speaker and our smartphone is buzzing or dinging. We can choose to ignore that. So that is one way that we cope with external interference. And it's very obvious that a smartphone is interfering in this way. Not all interference, though, not all sources of interference is external. Some interference is known as internal interference. So this means our own thoughts get in the way.
Okay.
So internal interference has been conceptualized as intrusions. Your listeners may be familiar with the term intrusive thoughts. So these occur spontaneously and without intention, and they sort of get in the way of us being able to accomplish our task. We engage in mind wandering. We're trying to pay attention, but before we know it, we're elsewhere. We don't want these to interfere, but they do.
Yeah.
It may also be that we try to, while we're paying attention to a primary task, for example, or going back to that example of listening to a speaker or a teacher, internal diversions are like external interruptions insofar as we try to do both. So you may have been in a situation where you're trying to pay attention, and while you're listening to that speaker, you're also trying to create a grocery list in your head.
Okay. Yeah.
So interference is multifaceted. The way that our world is interfering with us is both external and internal. Sometimes we try to juggle both. Other times we try to ignore it. And again, it's pretty well established that smartphones are a major source of external interference. But research is starting to look at how they may be a source of internal interference.
Interesting.
And yeah. So what this small body of work has found is that smartphone notifications, not using a smartphone, but just the notifications, the sound of an incoming text message or a call, is disrupting performance on tasks. And there's this growing body of work showing that these brief notifications are disruptive, even though the participant isn't using the device. This work has even shown that even the sight of a smartphone is disruptive. So in one study by Thornton and colleagues, participants performed a task. It was a digit task, a cognitive task. And then while they were performing this task, either a phone was left on the desk or a notebook was left on the desk. The participants did not interact with these things, but they did worse when a phone was left on a desk than when a notebook was left on the desk.
Wow.
Suggesting that the sight of a smartphone is disruptive, even though it didn't make any noise or they didn't interact with it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. All right. Y'all onto something now. Okay. I'm following.
Yeah. So neuroscience is looking at this as well. Notifications are disruptive. Neural activity, indicative of superior cognitive ability and greater concentration, we tend to see this under conditions of no distraction compared to when the smartphone notification is presented. Now, one thing that researchers are still trying to parse apart is this truly internal interference? It's difficult to say because in some of this work, a notification is presented. And a notification is an external form of stimulus, right? It's a noise. Mm-hmm. But it's a very, very brief noise. And because it's so brief, performance should not be as impaired as what has been found. If it's really brief, we can just ignore it and move on. And it really shouldn't be impairing performance as much as what we're finding. So the current working theory is that notifications, yes, they're external stimulus, but they prompt or trigger internal interference.
Hmm.
And that they're causing participants or college students or whoever you're studying to mind wander. Or it's causing the individuals who are exposed to this to feel anxious about being separated from their device. And so this was what I wanted to look at further in my study.
Okay.
So what I did was I gave participants an academic task, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. And I was interested in how well they do this academic task. Some of them had to do the task while I sent them text messages. So trying to work on a task while texting, you know, students do this in the classroom, they do this at home, and we know this impacts performance. Another group of students had to do this task while a smartphone vibrated. So they weren't interacting with the device, but it was buzzing periodically.
Okay.
And then there was a third group that did this, and they just did the task. It was a control condition. And I had a pretty good sample size, 105 students in this project. They were college students. And what the task was what they do in their everyday college lives. They read a passage and had to answer questions about what they read. So here's the reading, take a quiz on it. Most college students are familiar with these kinds of tasks.
Hmm.
The manipulation took place during the reading portion. So in the vibration group, the notification group, the participants did that reading while a hidden smartphone vibrated. And the goal here, this was a very brief external stimulus, a noise, but the goal was to trigger internal interference. Would they start thinking about the source of that vibration? Those in the texting group had to respond to incoming text messages while they read. Right. So this is like a student who's trying to read and prepare for class, but they're also on their phone. There was no interference during the quiz. So the phone was taken away during the quiz and the vibration stopped during the quiz.
Okay.
And then, of course, there was a control condition who just read the passage and took the quiz. Right. We need to know how well students do this task when there's no interference present.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so what I found was, of course, those in the no interference group did the best. They had the highest scores on the quiz. What was interesting is that those in the vibration group and those in the active texting group performed equally poor.
Mm.
So there was no difference between their scores, but they scored lower than those in the control group. So responding to incoming text messages impaired performance as much as the vibrations. So even though the participants in the vibration group didn't have access to a phone, they just heard these notifications, they did as poorly on a quiz.
Okay.
So that has major implications for the classroom, right? Even if a student never takes their device out of their backpack, but it's buzzing, it might be just as distracting, or it might be potentially impairing their performance as much as actively texting.
Wow.
The other variable that I looked at was how long it took them to complete that quiz.
Okay.
And what I found was those who were exposed to the vibrations, that buzzing noise, took longer to complete the quiz than those who were actively texting.
Okay. All right.
And it's important to remember that the vibrations were only played during the reading portion, not the quiz portion. So the vibrations had stopped, but it still took them longer to complete the quiz than those who were actively texting during the reading portion.
Okay.
So ultimately, this suggests that well, we know external distraction impairs performance, but this is really showing those phone vibrations are particularly disruptive, and in this case, as disruptive as actively texting. And the fact that it took them longer to complete the quiz suggests that those brief external noises were enough to trigger internal interference. So it was enough to cause the participants to mind wander, or the mind wandering persisted into the quiz time.
Okay.
In other words, these students, you know, had struggled to concentrate. They were maybe anticipating another buzz, or they were wondering why that phone was vibrating. So the major takeaway here is that our smartphones can be distracting even when we're not actively using them, and that hearing notifications is particularly disruptive. So when we're not using our phones, turn them off or at least make them silent. But our phones are now also located on our wrist, right?
Right.
So it's very difficult when thinking, it's very difficult to create that perfect environment for learning.
Right. This is fascinating.
So that,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
No. I was just thinking, this is fascinating because this is, I mean, this has a lot of different implications, correct? I mean, it's like just being able to hear that. I mean, and you're right. I mean, I have definitely resisted. I never really got into the phone or the watch part of that. But I know so many people, right, who do. They got, you know, they have that, and it's in it. And, you know, and it, obviously it's connected to something. I don't even know how it works, but I'm just like, I'm old school. I like my watches to still, you know, tick. but I get that, those distractions and just how that affects them. I just found this out recently about y'all's department, that y'all don't allow any devices in any of the classrooms. Is that correct? At least that's what one of your majors told me.
Right. So students, in terms of note-taking, students take notes in a notebook. Laptops are not permitted. I do have an intentional technology policy in my class.
Okay.
And so if a student, if there's an in-class assignment, you know, maybe we do lecture for the first half of class, and then the second half, there's an in-class assignment. Students are permitted to use their device to submit that assignment.
Okay.
And I do that for organizational purposes. So they have access to that in Canvas, so they can use that to study from. And that actually, that policy is fairly new. I implemented it when we were doing the hybrid high flex teaching as a result of the pandemic.
Got it.
So in the past, students would submit that work on paper, but I found it helped students stay organized.
Okay.
All their submissions were organized in Canvas for them, and they could use them as study tools. But in terms of the notes that they take during lecture, no devices are permitted because it's too tempting. It's too tempting to multitask. And research shows not only does it interfere with the individual's quality of notes and retention of information, but it's also disruptive to nearby users.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a study, I believe Sana and colleagues did in 2013.
Okay.
So, yep, that's the rationale for that policy.
No, as a teacher, having been in the classroom and kind of seen some of the evolution of this, I mean, you think about distractions, right? It's like, when I taught middle school, it was, you know, the windows sometimes could be distracting. If you saw somebody else out at the park, or if you saw somebody passing the classroom door or whatever, but it's like, you know, it's like those little things can be distractions. But I think about, I've gone back and forth, and that's why I'm asking the question about, you know, devices, you know, in class. Mm-hmm. I've had a same thing, you know, strict no policy, no devices. And I, you know, I've gotten kind of slack, but definitely seeing what you're saying. And now, you know, in terms of the distraction, and now learning more about this, what you're talking about, just even the side distractions. So even if a person is like, okay, I'm going to pay attention here, but if their neighbor is looking at something and kind of giggling at a video that they're watching or whatever, or what, you know, whatever they may be doing online, that could also be, you know, distraction as well. How does this then play out? I mean, like for learning in general, what is some of your research told you in regards about that, and some of the implications, if you will, as we, you know, seem to be heading more and more into a digital era, so to speak.
So this is actually an area of research that I'm exploring more now. It's published. I'm just catching up with the reading. And I think a lot of the research that has been recently published is due to the fact that we needed to rely on technology because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And we see that technology can be used intentionally for on-task, when it's used for on-task purposes, it can be helpful.
Okay.
But resisting that temptation, for example, to check social media, to do online shopping, is still very difficult, particularly for a population whose frontal lobe isn't fully developed. So we have the prefrontal cortex that's responsible for things like decision, planning, inhibition. And we know that this continues to develop through our 20s. And so we don't have that fully functioning brain to resist that temptation. And so our job as educators, teachers, if you will, is to scaffold that. So reminders can be very helpful. Enforcing policies can be very helpful. No student is going to say, you know what, I really don't want to set myself up for success. I'm going to enroll in this class. No one says, I'm going to enroll in this class and I plan to fail. I want my smartphone to distract me, right? No one. Yeah. And I think a lot of blame is placed on students, but students don't sign up for classes with that intention. So it's our job to really help and guide them. to use these devices meaningfully. And what might feel like almost nagging is more so just nudging and helping that developing brain use the devices intentionally, if that makes any sense.
No, absolutely. It makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. Well, this is interesting because I showed a couple of articles that you sent me. I have students read those in my social media friends and family class. And we'll watch a video on multitasking about, you know, how it's just not possible. Because this is a question I wanted to ask you in regards to multitasking. There are still students who they believe like, oh, I got to get better at multitasking, that I can do multitasking. In regards to that, like being able to do these multiple things at one time, like, you know, I used to hear the excuse. I don't hear it so much anymore, but I used to hear the excuse from students like, hey, I can easily be on social media and still pay attention in class. I'm listening. What's your take on that and some of the work that you've done around that as well?
So multitasking is a term that I used today and a term that's used colloquially by us lay people to refer to doing two things at once. But if you were to ask a cognitive psychologist to define this, they would say multitasking is a misnomer and we engage in a process known as task switching. Mm. So we're not actually able to do two things at once. Side note, maybe if they're very, very different and very simple. But for the most part, when we're talking about cognitive tasks, like trying to process a message on social media and trying to understand a lecture a teacher is giving, that's cognitive work. And we actually switch between these tasks very, very quickly. Hmm. It feels like we're multitasking, but we're not. And each switch can impact our performance or our ability to learn, our ability to retain information. And so task switching is difficult, cognitively speaking.
Okay.
But it doesn't feel like we're task switching because these switches are so brief. And then the research on that is a little mixed. There's actually some work showing that heavy multitaskers fare worse than light multitaskers.
Oof.
So they're not setting themselves up for success.
What is the difference between, maybe that's too broad, but like when you talk about heavy multitaskers or light multitaskers, like what is it? Someone who says, "Oh yeah, no, I can have these three things going." I mean, how does that get defined? Mm.
So you are catching me where I don't have the paper in front of me.
They
had participants report how much they multitasked, and I think they used a threshold, like a cutoff point. And if they were above that cutoff point, they were defined as a heavy multitasker. And if below that, were a light multitasker.
Got it. No, that makes sense. So what, in your educated conclusions and implications, what are some of those implications for us as we think about, you know, being constantly on, right? It's like you got, whether it's TV, whether it's games, whether it's some kind of, there's a screen that we have access to, I would say, is, you know, here in the West, especially in the US, at, you know, any given moment of the day. Again, anecdotally speaking, I remember a time when everything shut off pretty much at midnight and then came back on at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. That's no longer the case. It's 24-hour, you know, news cycle, 24-hour shows, you know, circuit. I mean, so what are some of the implications that you can take away from both your research and some of the other stuff that you've studied? If that question makes sense, I may be too broad.
It's broad, but it's an important one. And I think that what researchers in media psychology and cognitive psychology and development are trying to do is build a more comprehensive understanding. So there are some folks who study the effects on sleep. Others who look at emotional functioning or emotional well-being. There are others who have applied like an addictions framework, looking at the addictive qualities of a smartphone. And so I think to answer your question, which is broad with a broad answer, is I think when there's any substance or behavior that possesses addictive qualities, so like alcohol or gambling, perhaps smartphones and other technologies fall in here. We know that they have an effect on the dopaminergic system, which plays a role in addiction. So ultimately, knowledge about the mechanisms that drive or impede use is needed. And my goal is to really help contribute to this this understanding of how smartphones disrupt our livelihood. The goal is for us to make more intentional choices about how we use devices and to be prepared for situations and contexts that might result in altered usage. You mentioned earlier that the smartphone is a tool, and we need to continue to remember that, you know, we as humans are in charge of that tool. And the fact that many adults, younger college students, but also middle-aged and older adults have reported losing themselves to their devices, right? The tool is taking over. So it's a sneaky tool. So understanding the ways that this tool might creep into our lives and start to take over is really important. And it allows us to take a step back and be intentional. I see my role as researcher and educator, for me, these two identities are intertwined, is to take this work and I can use it in the classroom, right? So I can create policies that are in the best interest of my students, but I can also help foster their growing metacognitive skills or their growing metacognitive competence about so they can make decisions that are in the best interest of their learning and well-being. I know that's a bit broad.
No, this is good. You just got me thinking, about this and just, you know, the use of technology in the class. Communication theorist back in the day. Oh man, I am bouncing his name. I was just talking about him the other day. He wrote the book Amusing Ourselves to Death, but his take, and this was back in the 80s. I believe he passed in the 90s. Back in the 80s was, you know, that entertainment and, you know, this type of environment that, you know, was being created. And obviously back in the 80s, you know, pales in comparison to what we have now. But, you know, he was talking about, and even had strong criticisms of, you know, like something like Sesame Street, right, in terms of it just being more entertainment than learning. And of course, some of the educators and executives around, you know, Sesame Street that helped create it were, you know, they kind of pushed back and whatnot. But my point being is that his whole thing, and this is what I, you know, have students process, is, you know, was like, it's difficult to take you know, the news serious when it's like they're, you know, they're after ratings, not necessarily looking at, you know, people's concern. And so this, I kind of opens up the broader, at least for me, the broader question of media's role in our lives. I mean, so let me ask you this question more specifically. Now that we have some knowledge behind, especially after the 2016 election, right? We know that these places are selling information, our information, right? We have much more knowledge now, or at least hopefully some of us do, most of us do, in regards to how our device tracks us from place to place and, you know, in terms of what we buy. How is some of these things factoring into some of your research? For example, just, you know, the use of colors, for example, to, you know, to keep people, the use of notifications to keep people engaged in that particular app, whether it be TikTok, Instagram, whatever that may be. What are some of the ways you see, or, you know, or maybe this, you know, I don't know if you've gotten into this yet, in terms of just how these companies have actually used psychology, but I would say in an almost unethical way of keeping people engaged in this particular app or this particular program. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it is an area that I don't do research on, directly, but I can certainly speak to it. When we think about schedules of reinforcement and we look at some classic learning theories from psychology, I can answer that question. So if we think about, what makes slot machines so addictive, gambling so addictive, is you're not rewarded every time you pull that. You might be rewarded after 2 pulls of that lever or 15 pulls of that lever. And that is known as a variable ratio schedule of reinforcement. And that is a very powerful ratio of reinforcement. So it's going to really capture the user, in this case, the gambler. Our phones work in a very similar way, right? So we don't know what pickup is going to result in something reinforcing on our social media, right? Our Facebook or our TikTok or whatever app you're talking about. So we do see the application of psychological research being used to do what you're suggesting, increase our usage and our interaction with the device. Also, speaking about this now is reminding me of a study. It was published not too long ago by Heitenmeier and Olalu in 2021 that looked at humans' interactions with their devices. And what they found was that the majority of interactions, I think it was close to 90%, interactions with our devices were not due to a notification, but rather we just pick them up, almost as if by habit. It was something in the high 80s or 90% of these interactions. So I talked a whole lot earlier about how notifications are disruptive, but it seems like even not having notifications is disruptive, for lack of a better way to put that. We're really preoccupied by these devices, and that picking them up might now be pretty habitual.
This is fascinating. And by the way, a side note, the person I was thinking about is Dr. Neil Postman. He was the guy who wrote the book. But in his research around just, again, media and media engagement, he didn't necessarily look at the educational part as much as it looking at, some of the effects of, constant entertainment, constant, and also looking at how he was suggesting that a new generation was demanding being entertained in the classroom and whatnot. But I just wanted to make note of that. But this is fascinating. Yeah. I think in regards to just, the implications of this, and particularly, what we find ourselves currently, right? You see, this post-pandemic era, right? We now know that Zoom and Microsoft Teams and Google Chat, I mean, those things are now almost indispensable, right, to meetings. And, you don't necessarily have to be. I mean, I know there's some people who say, oh, no, you have to be. And but most people are like, well, we know they work. So, and if we're still getting the job done. This is fascinating, Dr. O'Toole. This is, I really appreciate you, taking the time and breaking this down. What areas haven't we touched on that you would like to say here before we wrap up?
Oh boy. Well, first of all, Dr. Hutch, thank you for having me. I think my big takeaway here is to just be intentional and know that these tools are sneaky, and that we can lose ourselves to these tools. And that kind of being more intentional, being more mindful, isn't the perfect solution, but it's an antidote that we have for now. We are moving toward a world in which technology isn't going away. So we will have to learn to cope with it. And there's some good research out there. Just thinking about coping mechanisms or coping skills, abstention from your device, just cutting it out, that tends to not be the best strategy. It tends to actually increase feelings of negative feelings, craving, distress, reduced life satisfaction. But a more moderate approach, like limiting use. So one study, I think, would say like 30 minutes a day, or batching notifications. So notifications are held and then delivered at predictable times during the day. This appears to have more positive effects. So just thinking about ways that we can tweak our relationship with technology might create that environment that's conducive for our learning and well-being. So I don't want to leave it with something too final because we're not done yet.
Yeah, right?
We're not done studying this, but that's where the research is for now.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you so much for breaking some of this stuff down and, you know, putting it into, you know, smaller pieces for us to understand. I love that. And I love that, you know, part of and component, you know, of research and in particularly in different fields. So thank you so much for taking the time and coming out today.
For sure. Thanks for having me, Dr. Hodge.
What is it you wanted me to reconcile myself to? I was born here almost 60 years ago. I'm not going to live another 60 years. You've always told me it takes time. It has taken my father's time, my mother's time, my uncle's time, my brother's and my sister's time, my niece's and my nephew's time. How much time do you want for your progress?
I hate you naturally.
And I hate black people.
Things are going to get worse before they get better.
What is presented to me as an American does not look like me, does not think like me, does not smell like me.
Because you're not allowed to be a black man in corporate America.
You give us a hard time for being white and being American and being in control.
And when you live under a situation like that constantly, and then you ask me, you know, whether I approve of violence, I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, there's a lot of crazy stuff happening right now. And you know what? We need a space where we can debrief some of it and deconstruct. If you've been looking for a POC-centered podcast that engages with intersectionality, religion, critical race theory, and some hip-hop culture, then you need to check out Profane Faith. I'll be your host, Daniel White Hodge, and we go in every other week. So check us out wherever you find your podcasts, or check us out at whitehodgepodcasts.com to see what other platforms we're on. Cool? All right. Peace.